This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Humanity's health depends on the health of Mother Earth. Yet, we seem hell-bent on destruction.
That was UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres with a message on Earth Day about the planet's dark challenges. Details coming up. Also, the latest ceasefire effort in Sudan has failed. And Uganda's president is returning a draft anti-homosexuality bill to Parliament for review. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Kenya's President William Ruto has offered to mediate between Sudan's warring parties. This comes after multiple ceasefires failed to hold and fighting raged for a seventh day today in Khartoum and other Sudanese cities. VOA correspondent Mariama Diallo reports from Nairobi.
Kenyan leader William Ruto made the offer to host a mediation process between the warring parties as he conveyed a message of goodwill to the people of Sudan as the holy month of Ramadan comes to an end. Muruthi Mutiga, Africa Program Director of the International Crisis Group, says it's encouraging that neighbors, including Kenya, are eager to help resolve the Sudan crisis. However, he's skeptical that Ruto or any one leader can do it alone.
The reality, though, is that you need concerted action by multiple external partners because nobody has really substantial leverage over the main actors.
Ruto said he strongly believes that a peacefully negotiated solution to the conflict in Sudan is within reach. He expressed hope the fighting parties will respond to appeals to end the fighting put forth this week by the East African Regional Bloc, IGAD, and the African Union. But Mutiga says major powers need to step in.
It's good to support the regional initiative that might send the Kenyans, the Djiboutians, and South Sudanese heads of state, but they need to be backed up by serious external pressure, particularly by two key players, Saudi Arabia and the US. They have considerable access to the main actors. They might be able to move the needle, and they might be able to encourage them to accept talks.
Ruto said halting the fight will be a gesture of goodwill and will stop a descent into conflict, insecurity, instability, and humanitarian crisis. On Friday, the Rapid Support Forces of Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, also known as Hemeti, agreed to a 72-hour ceasefire. The Sudanese Army General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan did not seem interested.
That might suggest that the RSF is under some military pressure, but we have to remember this is a very large force, very motivated force, and one with a lot at stake, the RSF. So now the armed forces seems determined to try and crush them militarily. But that's partly because they worry that a truce might allow the RSF to reinforce.
Regardless, Mutiga said it is essential that the two parties move toward an agreement sooner rather than later because the suffering in Sudan has been horrific. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
Sudan's paramilitary declared a ceasefire with the military for the end of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan, but like previous efforts, it failed as fighting continued. Michael Atit reports from the capital, Khartoum.
Sudan's paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, said it had agreed to a 72-hour truce on humanitarian grounds, starting at 6 a.m. local time on Friday to coincide with the Muslim holiday of Eid al-Fitr. The capital, Khartoum, was rocked by bombing and shelling earlier on Friday. There was no immediate comment from the army, and its chief, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, did not mention a ceasefire in a pre-recorded speech posted on the army's Facebook page. The truce coincides with the blessed Eid al-Fitr to open humanitarian corridors to evacuate citizens and give them the opportunity to greet their families, the RSF said in a statement. The truce coincides with the blessed Eid of Al-Fitr to open humanitarian grounds, to open humanitarian corridors, to evacuate citizens and give them opportunity to greet their families, the RSF said in a statement. The RSF said it had to act in self-defense to repel what it described as a coup attempt, adding that it is committed to a complete ceasefire during the armistice period. In a televised message to the nation, Sudan's military leader Abdel Fattah al-Burhan reiterated the commitment of the military to restore stability in the country. He extended his message of Eid to all Sudanese people despite the ongoing fighting for the restoration of a civilian rule in Sudan. He said, the country has been afflicted by a deep wound which has taken victims, injured many, displaced family, destroyed institutions and homes. The ruin and destruction and the sound of gunfire have not allowed a space for joy that our people across the beloved country deserve, and they are deeply saddened by this. Al-Burhan says he remains hopeful the military will win the battle, and he vowed to restore peace and stability. He said they are confident they will overcome this tribulation with the wisdom and strength that will protect the safety of the country and will allow a safe transition to a civilian rule. At least 330 people have been killed in the power struggle between two previously allied leaders of the ruling military junta, Army Chief al-Burhan and the RSF leader General Muhammad Hamdan Dagalo. Michael Atid for VOA News, Khartoum, Sudan.
VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Bob is traveling with U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin in Europe for meetings with European allies. She spoke with VOA's Kate Pondawson earlier today about U.S. preparations for a possible evacuation of American embassy staff in Khartoum.
Well, so the Pentagon with U.S. Africa Command in the lead on this, they've said that they are moving additional troops and equipment to Djibouti to prepare for the possible evacuation of U.S. embassy personnel from Sudan. I'm being told by officials that they are planning to only evacuate U.S. embassy personnel at this time. That would be roughly 75 individuals. And I've been told that no orders have been given at the moment from the State Department, but they're just taking these precautionary measures.
Are there any concerns? Is the U.S. expressing any concerns about the risk of widening insecurity because of this conflict?
Well, Washington has definitely called for the two groups to, quote, renounce violence and return to negotiations. And they've even put the blame on the country's two top generals. They've said these men, these generals are responsible for ensuring the protection of civilians and non-combatants. Almost a warning saying, please make sure that our personnel and our citizens remain safe in the country. As you know, the fighting broke out on Saturday, and it has just been chaotic ever since. There have been hundreds killed.
That was Carla Babb, the VOA Pentagon correspondent. She spoke to my colleague from the U.S. Ramstein Air Base in Germany, where U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has been meeting with European allies. Some regional analysts have little hope the warring sides in Sudan's conflict will agree on a sustainable truce anytime soon. VOA's Ignatius Anor reports.
Sudan's two powerful military leaders, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, commander of the National Armed Forces, and the Rapid Support Forces Chief, General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, have not honored repeated ceasefire declarations. Even international calls for three-day truce over Eid to allow aid to reach civilians and foreign governments to evacuate their nationals have failed. Michael Jones is a research fellow in terrorism and conflict at London's Royal United Services Institute for Defence and Security Studies. He told VOA that while calls for a truce are welcome, their sustainability is uncertain. Jones questioned the wider approach to resolving the simmering tensions for the longer term, including what he described as, quote, wider systemic and structural issues, end of quote, that led to the breakdown of law and order. The analyst also said that with Khartoum's airport still closed to most flights, key hurdles remain to providing aid and evacuating foreign nationals.
It does inevitably pose a significant disruption to humanitarian supply lines, the ability of international donors, NGOs, domestic civil society organizations, aid organizations, humanitarian organizations, civic activists to move around and operate. And that has a knock-on effect on a very, an existing precarious situation where, drought across the Horn of Africa generally has been a significant issue. Risk of famine across Somalia, Ethiopia, Sudan, and elsewhere continues to be an ongoing problem. And so this will only exacerbate civilian suffering.
The fighting began a week ago after Ali Buhan and the girl, known as Hameti, argued over plans to create a civilian-led transitional government and integrate the RSF into the National Army. David Otto Indele is the executive director of Geneva Center for African Security and Strategic Studies. He says that although neighboring countries have expressed willingness to act as mediators, the implications of the conflict are serious in a region already dealing with drought, the aftermath of a conflict in Ethiopia and sporadic violence in South Sudan.
What I'm looking at this point in time is perhaps, to see a coalition between the African Union and the UN to deploy effectively and physically some of its personnel who can be trusted, who can have an immediate conversation with the leadership of the generals, to have that conversation. But right now, I do not believe that it is going to be successful because both sides are looking to consolidate. They want to make sure that they have control of critical infrastructures.
Ndele also said with Sudanese civilians facing shortages of food, water and medical supplies, their predicaments could be heightened as the world is already dealing with another war, Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Ignatius Anno, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. Rights activists have welcomed Uganda's president returning a draft anti-homosexuality bill to parliament for review, saying it gives them more time to fight it. The bill includes some of the world's harshest anti-gay punishments, including life imprisonment for acts of homosexuality and a possible death penalty. President Yoweri Museveni says lawmakers need to consider amnesty for those who renounce homosexuality, but the penalties are expected to remain. Halima Tumani reports from Kampala, Uganda.
Human rights activists say the move by President Yoweri Museveni to return the anti-homosexuality bill to parliament for review provides half relief and a fighting chance against the bill. On Thursday, Museveni, in a meeting with legislators of the ruling National Resistance Movement Party, congratulated them upon passing the bill in March. Museveni said that while he agrees with the bill, legislators need to make changes to not frighten someone who, in his words, needs rehabilitation and wants to come out. The bill was widely condemned for what human rights activists have called some of the world's harshest punishments against the gay community. The bill, if passed, would mandate life in prison for anyone who engages in homosexual acts for up to 20 years for promoting homosexuality and a 3-year sentence for children convicted of homosexuality. Certain acts of gay sex would warrant the death penalty. Speaking to VOA, the ruling party's chief whip in parliament, Dennis Hampson Obua, clarified what parliament will review.
In order for some proposed clauses to be reviewed, to be reinforced, to be strengthened. There is also the question of rehabilitation of the victims, but we also agreed in principle that the proposed sentences in terms of punishment for promotion, recruitment, and publicizing acts of homosexuality will be sustained.
The NRM caucus will also likely decriminalize failure to report homosexuality. The bill as passed would require that everyone must report a person known to be gay to police, but Museveni wants that provision removed. Amnesty International continues to call on President Museveni to veto the bill. Roland Ebole is Amnesty's regional researcher.
It is sad that he did not veto the bill, but what we are actually saying, the provisions of the bill are very dangerous. The death sentence, having sentences that go against the constitution, I'm really worried about the forced testing of persons because they are suspected of having committed aggravated homosexuality and especially targeting HIV/AIDS community.
Amnesty also argues that forced testing will increase stigma and set back Uganda in its achievements against HIV and AIDS. The United States pays for antiretroviral drugs for hundreds of thousands of Ugandans each year, and the country director for the U.S. Agency for International Development recently said the bill, if passed, would make it impossible for the agency to work in Uganda. John Ameka, founder of the Redla Foundation, a group that provides shelter to queer women, says Museveni sending back the bill for review provides some sort of hope.
We could have a chance to have a conversation on how far do we protect queer persons in Uganda, because the bill so far has caused a lot of damage, especially in the lowest communities that are offering the support. But the best hope for me would be when in the end of it all, be noticed in just like policies, organizings and representation.
Museveni has now called for a meeting with the proposer of the bill, Justice Forum opposition party legislator Asman Vasalirwa, to agree on amendments to the bill before Parliament considers it again. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala, Uganda.
Tomorrow is Earth Day, and the United Nations warns that humanity faces catastrophe because of its relentless abuse of the planet. It says people and governments continue to ignore the threat of climate change, with global carbon emissions still too high to avoid devastating impacts on the environment in the near future. Darren Taylor reports.
The message from UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres ahead of Earth Day is a dark one, and is being broadcast by many of Africa's major media networks.
Humanity's health depends on the health of Mother Earth. Yet, we seem hell-bent on destruction. Our actions are laying waste to forests, jungles, farmland, wetlands, oceans, coral reefs, rivers, seas and lakes. Biodiversity is collapsing as 1 million species teeter on the brink of extinction. We must end these relentless and senseless wars on nature. We have the tools, the knowledge, and the solutions.
But, says Guterres, the world's not using those skills to protect the environment, and wealthier nations aren't scaling up investments to protect poorer regions from the climate change that's already ravaging them. While Saturday is Earth Day, the UN designates every April 22nd as World Mother Earth Day. Stellenbosch Business School Senior Lecturer in Sustainability, Jaco Folschenk, says global powers continue to overinvest in war, for example, and to underinvest in the future of the planet.
I think for the last 30 years, we've seen the United Nations trying to make provision for the things that we need to do. I think there's been lots of commitment from their side, but what's been lacking is agreement between countries. What we typically see is that countries like America, the Middle East, even small islands, all have their own agendas. Also, lobby groups behind them from oil, from the beef industry, etc., that's been present.
His message to Africans is not to wait for governments, including their own, to sign laws and make agreements aimed at protecting the planet. Folschenk says positive change begins with individuals. He uses meat consumption as an example. The Food and Agriculture Organization says agriculture produces about 18% of all harmful gas emissions, and beef production generates more than 40% of that. Folschenk points out that Africans consume a lot of meat, and therefore are unwittingly responsible for global warming.
We need to make a mind shift. If you invite your in-laws to dinner and you do not serve them meat, it's frowned upon. So those are something that as a society we need to change. It's not people do not want to change, but we can make certain changes and make it easier for people. For instance, in restaurants, one of the things that we can do is if we move a meal like a risotto, if you just move that from the vegetarian section into the main meal section, the orders of that meal goes up by double, by 100%.
Another example of positive behavior change, he says, springs from the German city Berlin. During the COVID pandemic, many Berliners stopped using cars and public transport in fear of contracting coronavirus and began cycling instead. City authorities have since built many bicycle lanes.
So they've seen a massive shift away from people using cars in Berlin to using bicycles. They made it fun, they made it easy, they made it safe. We do not have to give up our quality of life for us to actually make a big contribution to climate change without us having to wait for international agreements.
Like Guterres, Folcheng calls on African governments to stop putting narrow self-interest first and to do all they can to safeguard the earth and, by extension, their people. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
British Deputy Prime Minister Dominic Raab has resigned following an investigation of several formal complaints that he bullied colleagues. In a resignation letter posted on Twitter today, Raab said, "I called for the inquiry and undertook to resign if it made any findings of bullying whatsoever. I believe it is important to keep my word." But he said he believes that the probe's two adverse findings are flawed and set a dangerous precedent for the conduct of good government by setting the threshold for bullying so low. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has not issued a statement on Raab's resignation. Libyans are celebrating Islam's Eid al-Fitr holiday and ending their daily Ramadan fasts on two separate days this year because of bitter political splits that persist despite years of peace efforts. According to Reuters, religious authorities in East Libya, aligned with the parliament, which is based there, said they had sighted the crescent moon on Thursday, setting Friday as Eid. In Tripoli, the capital, religious authorities linked to the national interim government said they had not seen the moon and the holiday would not begin until Saturday, meaning people should fast another day. The date of Eid is normally set by the official religious authority in each country, but Libya has had little stability since a 2011 NATO-backed uprising against ruler Muammar Gaddafi. The country split in 2014 between warring factions in East and West, a rift that remains despite comparative peace since 2020. While people in areas controlled by Eastern factions appear to be universally celebrating Eid on Friday, people living in Tripoli and some other parts of the West seemed split between those celebrating and those still fasting. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest development on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Nfunganye, and our engineer, Helen Cordian, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.